Support for NPR podcasts comes from HBO, presenting The Wire. The final season premieres this Sunday at 9 p.m.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Denzel Washington, directed and stars in the new film, The Great Debaters. It's nominated for a Golden Globe as Best Dramatic Film. It's competing in that category with American Gangster, which Washington also stars in. He's nominated for a Golden Globe for his performance as a drug kingpin in that film. The Great Debaters is the second film that Washington has directed. Like several of the films he starred in, such as Cry Freedom, Malcolm X, The Hurricane, and American Gangster, The Great Debaters is based on a true story. Set in the early 1930s, it's about the debating team at Wiley College, a black school in the segregated South. The youngest student on the team is James Farmer Jr., who went on to co-found CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and to help organize the Freedom Riders. Washington plays Professor Melvin B. Tolson, the coach of the debating team, whose goal is to convince a top white university to allow his team to debate theirs. In this scene, Professor Tolson is in the classroom addressing the students on his debating team.
Anybody know who Willie Lynch was? Anybody? Raise your hand. He was a vicious slave owner in the West Indies. The slave masters in the colony of Virginia were having trouble controlling their slaves, so they sent for Mr. Lynch to teach them his methods.
Keep the slave physically strong, but psychologically weak and dependent on the slave master.
Keep the body, take the mind. I and every other professor on this campus are here to help you to find, take back, and keep your righteous mind.
Denzel Washington, welcome to Fresh Air. What interested you in making The Great Debaters?
I just thought that it was a very interesting story, one I hadn't heard about. I'd never heard of Wiley College. I knew very little about Mel Tolson and his poetry. I knew somewhat about James Farmer Jr. as a civil rights leader, but that was all. So it was just a very good story, sort of a, you know, David against Goliath story, the underdog kind of story, a little train that could, and ultimately a very uplifting story.
What have you learned as an actor about what makes a good director? You've worked with many of them. Are there things that you did or did not want to do based on your experiences with directors?
You know, you don't even realize everything you've learned until you have a chance to apply it, you know, or you don't realize what you've retained, you know, until you have a chance to apply it. Certain things click in. You know, for example, Ed Zwick was always good at creating a, we did Glory. We had a whole, like, Civil War training camp. You know, I applied that to this film. I met a gentleman by the name of Dr. Freeman, who is the head debating coach at Texas Southern, which is one of the top debating schools in the country. And we set up a mini camp for them, and they were there. They went to Texas Southern and studied and, in fact, got a chance to debate against the freshman and sophomore team.
You know, one thing you can't do is send your actors into the past so that they can study the past, because the film's set in, what, 1935. Mm-hmm. So what do you do to orient young actors about what the past was like, a past that precedes you, too?
Well, you collect information, you share what you have with them, and they go do their homework. First of all, you hire the right actors. So you hire the ones that are going to go and do the homework and find out about their characters and find out about the way times were. You know, you surround them with music and books and photographs. And in this case, we had Mel Tolson's two sons who are still alive. Henrietta Wells, who Samantha Book is based upon, is still alive. So Journey, being the smart and talented actress she is, spent a ton of time with Henrietta. And, went, you know, she's 96 years old. But she went and hung out with her in Houston and just, you know, got it from the horse's mouth. And first thing that I did was to visit Wiley College and their archives and also meet a good half a dozen people in their 90s who were there then. I taped them and, in fact, filmed them and thought about using them in the film at one point. But we're definitely going to use them in the DVD.
You know, there's a scene in The Great Debaters where you, as the coach, are drilling the debaters in a voice elocution and projection exercise. And so you're in a rowboat in the middle of a lake. They're standing at the shore of the lake, you know, on the edge of the lake. They mm-hmm. each have like a cork in their mouth, and they right. have to recite things clearly and loudly enough so that you can hear them in the middle of the lake in your boat.
Right.
And I
right.
thought, that is a really interesting
yeah, I know,
vocal
right?
exercise. Did you ever have to do anything like that as
no,
an actor?
I didn't have to do that one. But in fact, Todd Black, my producing partner, mentioned it one day that he had to do it in speech class. And I just remembered it. And I said, we're going to do that. You know, because we knew we needed a couple of scenes where he's training the students. And there were some written. And we had gone back and forth as, you know, as to what we would do. At one point, we had a scene where they were out on the football field and enunciating. And then we turned and find out that they were actually walking through the band while the band is blasting music. So we didn't go with that idea. We went with this idea. And it's sort of light and a little bit funny and refreshing coming off that sort of intense scene with the pig farmers right before it.
At about the same time you were playing, you know, shooting The Great Debaters and playing a professor in it, you were making American Gangster and playing a gangster who was very powerful in Harlem and smuggled in heroin directly from Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
Not at the same time. We actually finished American
Just
Gangster.
Just in sequence?
Uh-huh. No, we finished American Gangster like November of 2006. And then I started shooting I was preparing for Great Debaters for 3 years, but we didn't start shooting until April of this year.
I see. Okay. Does it affect you differently when you're off the set? If you're playing, you know, a drug kingpin who will willingly kill somebody if he thinks it's necessary versus, you know, a professor whose like mission is training his students to be winning debaters. I mean, that's such two different kinds of personalities. Does it change what you take home with you at night?
You know, I read a book years ago, Cagney by Cagney, written by James Cagney. And he talked about, you know, it's his job. He's at the studio. You do your job. You know, you shut your door and you go get in your car and go home. I guess it does. I couldn't tell you what it is because I'm not thinking about it. But basically, well, it's different in the case of directing because you don't ever turn off. You're working all the time. But when I finished American Gangster, I was done with it. I didn't, you know, think about going into the drug businesses. I don't know. You know, it's a job. And I've been at it a long time. And I know how to do my job, I think. But no, I don't think I carry it around too much. You know, when you're preparing, you do purposely. You wear the clothes. You're getting ready, so you're preparing and you're trying to literally walk in someone's shoes or walk in the character's shoes. So, but once you feel comfortable with that, then you start to leave all of that behind, I think. I hope.
Well, we should hear a clip from American Gangster. This is a movie that you're nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Drama. And you play a drug kingpin in Harlem in this, and you've brought up your family from the South, and you've basically made your brothers into foot soldiers for your operation. And one of your brothers, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, is kind of so kind of taken by like the money and what he could do with it. So he's wearing this outfit with, you know, like a, it's the early 70s with a big collar and a big hat, and you think it's like much too flashy. And mm-hmm. in this scene, you're explaining why that's a problem.
What is that you got?
What's what, man?
Yeah, that. What you got on?
It's a very, very, very nice suit.
That's a very, very, very nice suit. That's a clown suit. That's a costume.
Come on, man.
With a big sign on it that says arrest me. You understand? You're too loud. You're making too much noise. Look at me. The loudest one in the room is the weakest one in the room. I told you that. All right? But you trying to be like Nicky Barnes and them?
What's your problem with Nicky, man? I like
Nicky. I ain't got no problem with Nicky. Oh, you like Nicky?
Yeah.
You want to be like Nicky? You want to be super fly, huh? You want to work for him, huh? Share a jail cell with him, maybe cook for him?
He wants to talk to you.
Oh, so now you talking to him about me now? What?
No, it ain't
about
like that.
What is it,
it
about?
It ain't like that.
Then what
you
is
were
it
talking,
like?
Your name came up. I
about
told him,
what?
I don't know, man. I told him I'd tell you.
You know, boy, you. You know, if you wasn't my brother, I'd kill you. You know that, don't you? I'm taking you shopping this week.
That's my guest, Denzel Washington, with Chiwetel Ejiofor in a scene from American Gangster. I remember when I interviewed Michael Caine, he talked about how when you're playing somebody who's very powerful, you shouldn't like, move around and fidget a lot, gesture a lot, because powerful people don't have to do all that because the people underneath them are hanging on the powerful person's every word and looking for every clue that they can about what his mood is and what's he going to do next and how he's reacting to things. And it seems to me like you're that kind of person in American Gangster. You don't move around a lot. You don't gesture a lot. You've got a lot of power, and you know you do. You met Frank Lucas, the person who your role is based on. Was he like that when you met him?
Well, I mean, you know, Gotti moved around a lot. He had a lot of power. I don't know. I personally wouldn't hold any hard, fast rule about who moves around a lot or who doesn't.
Uh-huh.
I've never thought of it that way. The perception of power is power. I think that the perception is established by his violence right at the top of the movie.
Yeah.
So
uh-huh.
You see a guy who's this violent, who can walk down the street, shoot somebody in the head, come back inside and forget. His only question was, what was I talking about before I was interrupted? You know, that's a sociopath. I think, you know, his movement or lack of movement, I never thought about that at all.
I really like American Gangster and your performance in it.
Thank you.
Does it ever bother you to play people who aren't role models? Like in life, so many people see you as a role model. Does it bother you? Like in The Great Debaters, you are very role model. You know, you're very ethical.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't bother me. I mean, I do. I'm selfish. I think an artist has to be. I'm not worried about what people think. I'm going to play the parts that I find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It bothered me more to be just pigeonholed into doing what people think is ethical, or, you know, that's boring to me. I don't pick parts with that in mind, and I just find interesting stories. If it's interesting to me, then I do it.
My guest is Denzel Washington. He directed and stars in the new film, The Great Debaters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Denzel Washington. He directed and stars in the new film, The Great Debaters, which is nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Movie Drama. One of your most non-role model performances is in Training Day, for which you won an Oscar. And mm-hmm. I'd like to play a short scene from that. And in this scene, you're a cop who is really brutal when he wants to be and really nasty. And you're initiating this new rookie cop who's your partner, played by Ethan Hawke. And in this scene, Ethan Hawke has been trying to apprehend two suspects, probably like crack addicts. And they've beaten him up. He's finally gotten them handcuffed. You haven't helped him at all. You've basically just been watching. And then after he gets them handcuffed, you kind of move in, insult them, take $60 out of one of their pockets, and you decide not to arrest them. You just leave them there. And Ethan Hawke is mystified. And here's the conversation in the car afterwards.
I'm gonna book that $60, huh? Yeah, go ahead. Book it into evidence, man. Where the suspects don't give you could go back and get the suspects.
I don't know where they are. You let them go.
Oh, I let them go.
Yeah, you let them go.
All right, man. You want to run a gun, man? Stay in patrol, okay? This is investigations, all right? Let the garbage men handle the garbage. We're professional anglers, okay? We go after the big fish. Chasing them monkey strong, crackhead motherfuckers. Anyway, you know they'd have killed you without hesitating.
That's why they belong in prison.
For what? They got beat down, they lost their rock, they lost their money, their message from Hillside probably gonna smoke them. I mean, Jesus, what more you want?
I want justice, right?
Is that not justice?
That's street justice.
What's wrong with street justice?
Oh, just let the animals wipe themselves out.
God
right?
willing. Everybody who looks like them. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. The good guys, they die first, right? Those school kids and moms, family men, they don't want to catch the stray bullets in the noodle. To protect the sheep, you gotta catch the wolf. And it takes a wolf to catch a wolf. You understand?
What?
I said you protect the sheep by killing the wolves. No, you didn't hear me. You listening, but you didn't hear me.
Yeah, all right, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever the f***.
Let me ask you this. When do you lock anybody up? I mean, it seems like you're pretty busy keeping people out.
What the f*** you talking about? You know what you're talking about, Biddy Boot. Got nothing but between your ears. They build jails because of me. Judges have handed out over 15,000 man years of incarceration time based on my investigations, okay? My record speaks for itself. How many felons have you collared? Huh? Yeah, I rest my case.
That's my guest, Denzel Washington, with Ethan Hawke in a scene from Training Day. And Denzel Washington won an Oscar for his performance in this film. And of course, after what we just heard, since you've said it takes a wolf to catch a wolf, you teach Ethan Hawke how to howl like a wolf. You make him howl.
Right.
Now, I read that you wanted to make sure that this cop, the character you played, was killed at the end, or that there were real mm-hmm. consequences for his behavior.
Exactly.
Was that not the case when you first saw the script?
No, not to the degree that was satisfying to me. Like I told the director, I couldn't justify him living in the worst way unless he died in the worst way. That the community turns their back on him. He's slapped around, crawling around on the ground like a snake, and basically gets fill full of lead. So we just made it a violent, awful ending for him.
And why did you insist on that?
I just thought that's what he deserved. I thought it was a bit of a cop-out the way the script was. And, it smelled like they were looking to do a part two or something.
Uh-huh. There's a scene in this where you're holding two guns on someone and you kind of scrape the guns against each other as if they're two knives that you're sharpening.
Uh-huh.
Was that a bit of business that you came up with when you were holding the guns?
Of course. I mean, it's just rhythm. Acting is like music, and you improvise and it's like jazz. There's no rhyme or reason to it. It's not a plan. I just did it. It's just a rhythm. It's just a rhythm. It's like you do. Stanislavski said, you cut 90%. You do all your research and you prepare and then you let it rip, and that's how it is. You practice the music and then you just play it.
Well, let's talk about another film that's very important in your career, and that's Malcolm X, which was directed by Spike Lee. Let's hear a scene from it. And this is a scene in which you're making a speech.
I must emphasize at the outstart that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is not a politician. So I'm not here this afternoon as a Republican, nor as a Democrat. Not as a Mason, nor as an L. Not as a Protestant, nor a Catholic. Not as a Christian, nor a Jew. Not as a Baptist, nor a Methodist. In fact, not even as an American. Because if I was an American, the problem that confronts our people today wouldn't even exist.
Now we ain't Americans, huh?
So I have to stand here today as what I was when I was born, a black man. Before there was any such thing as a Republican or a Democrat, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Mason or an elk, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Jew or a Christian, we were black people. In fact, before there was any such place as America, we were black. And after America has long passed from the scene, there will still be black people. I'm going to tell you like it really is. Every election year, these politicians are sent up here to pacify. They're sent here and set up here by the white man. This is what they do. They send drugs in Harlem down here to pacify us. They send alcohol down here to pacify us. They send prostitution down here to pacify us. Why, you can't even get drugs in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get prostitution in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get gambling in Harlem without the white man's permission. Every time you break the seal on that liquor bottle, that's a government seal you're breaking. Oh, I say it, again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run amok. This is what he does.
That's Denzel Washington in a scene from Malcolm X, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award. When did Malcolm X first enter your consciousness?
I hadn't heard that in about 15 years.
Yeah, what'd you think listening back?
That was interesting. I hadn't heard it in a long time. I hadn't heard it since I'd seen the movie, I guess, whenever it came out 15 years ago.
You did good.
Yeah, turned out all right. Sounded pretty good.
Yeah.
I believed him.
When did Malcolm X enter your consciousness?
I did a play about Malcolm X, actually, about 10, 11 years before that, down at the New Federal Theater in New York City, Henry Street Settlement, a fictional meeting between the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X. So that's when I really began to dig deep and listen to all the speeches and read his books and study the man. I mean, I knew who he was, but I didn't know who he was. until about 1981.
Denzel Washington will be back in the second half of the show. He directed and stars in the new film, The Great Debaters. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's music from the soundtrack of The Great Debaters, featuring singer Sharon Jones.
I'm a long, tall mama. They call me a chocolate brown. Give me two of whiskey and you'll see me clown. That's what my baby likes. That's what my baby likes. Well, he's crazy about me and he do let me have my fun. I'm 5 feet standing, 6 feet laying down. I'm a pig meat walk from my head.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Denzel Washington. He's nominated for a Golden Globe for his performance as a drug kingpin in the film American Gangster. He directed and stars in the new film The Great Debaters, which is nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Movie Drama. When we left off, we were talking about starring in the movie Malcolm X. He told me he first started studying Malcolm's writings a few years before the film, when he starred in a play about a fictional meeting between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad. I asked him if he was influenced by Malcolm's writings.
Oh, yeah, I would say absolutely. I mean, just a lot of things he said made sense. You know, for example, there's no way you can know where you're going unless you knew where you came from. So, you know, it says, hey, then study your history. Know what your history is. Absolutely. It's one of the greatest books I ever read is the autobiography of Malcolm X. I would suggest it to anyone. It is a great book.
Was there any, like, particular footage, like, you know, archival footage of Malcolm X that had the biggest impact on how you played him?
No, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't say there's one thing that had the biggest impact. But, you know, I looked at all the footage that there was. I will say that the Schomburg Library, when I first started working on the part, was just the best place. It became my home away from home, and it's a great resource library up in Harlem, 135th Street. And I can't say enough about the work that I did, not just on Malcolm X, but other parts over the years. I would always visit the Schomburg.
Let's go to the very early Denzel era. And let's see if our listeners recognize you in this scene. And hint, it's the pilot for a series, a TV series that ran a long time, and you co-starred throughout the run. And it helped make you a star. So here we go, the very early Denzel.
42-year-old white, obese female, 4-day history of right upper quadrant pain, no history of calithiasis or peptic ulcer disease.
Has the pain changed with time or position?
No, physical examination temperature was 39.5 degrees centigrade, blood pressure 130 over 80, no jaundice present.
Is the abdomen distended?
No, there's a +2/4 tenderness in the right upper quadrant. The liver is 10 centimeters in breadth, 2 centimeters below the right coastal margin. There is a palpable mass just below the liver edge with a positive Murphy sign.
Jesus.
That's your first
scene. I think I mispronounced
scene.
That. I think it's cholelithia. I think it's cholelithiasis. And it sounds like I said cholelithiasis. I believe any doctors out there, if they call in, let me know. I believe it's cholelithiasis.
Well, that's you in your first scene in the pilot of St. Elsewhere. Yeah.
But I remember that cholelithiasis. That's interesting.
That is. I hope you never had it, whatever the heck it is.
I couldn't tell you what it is.
How did you get the part on St. Elsewhere?
I was doing a great play, and I say that because it was, called a Soldier's Play, which went on to become A Soldier's Story. You know, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1982.
Right, the movie version was A Soldier's Story.
Yeah, movie version was A Soldier's Story. The play was an off-Broadway play in New York. And they came to New York reading actors for this TV series, Saint Elsewhere. I never really wanted to do television because I wanted to do plays and movies, and I didn't want to become well-known for television. But this was an interesting script with many characters, so my agent thought, well, you know, you could get lost amongst the other characters. And so they, to make a long story long, they chose two actors, I believe, from New York, myself and David Morse.
Was it colorblind casting, or did they know that Dr. Chandler was going to be African-American?
You'd have to ask them. I don't know, to be honest with you. I didn't ask. I wasn't dare going to ask at that point. It's like, oh, I can only do this if this is colorblind casting. No, I have no idea. I just auditioned for the part.
What was the audition like?
Shoot, that was 25 years ago. I don't remember. I guess it was good. I got the part.
You don't remember what you had to do?
Oh, no. I don't. I imagine maybe I read that scene. Maybe that's what I had to do. You know, and did you say that was from the pilot?
It's from the pilot.
That was from, so maybe that's probably what I had to read. That's a perfect example of where your speech training and training in the classics, you know, Shakespearean training comes in to be able to say those lines.
To rattle off all those medical conditions most people don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Cholelithiasis. I do remember that, though.
So straighten me out on something. When I say your name, should it be Denzel, equal beats on both syllables, or Denzel, more emphasis on the second syllable?
The doctor who delivered my father was named Dr. Denzel, and he had 11 or 12 brothers and sisters, so maybe they were running out of names, and they just named him after the doctor. So his name was pronounced Denzel Hayes Washington Sr. I'm Denzel Hayes Washington Jr. My mother would say Denzel, and both of us would show up. She said, all right, from now on, she says this is not true, but this is the way I remember it. But she said, from now on, you're Denzel. So I was named I was called Denzel, so we would know who she was screaming at.
I get it. So I could see room for a lot of confusion. Yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Bob Denzel. I don't know what his first name was, but it was actually his last name,
okay.
The doctor.
No, when you were growing up, your mother owned a hair salon?
Yeah.
And your father was a Pentecostal minister who also worked for the water department.
And S. Klein's on the square.
Oh.
He was a night watchman for Klein's up
Klein's
in
department store? Oh, I see. There's a difference.
On Central Avenue in Yonkers. Yeah, well, the original one was on the square, 14th Street.
On Union Square.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because it used to be called S. Klein's on the square.
Oh.
And so they had one up in Yonkers on Central Avenue, and he was the night man there. And he was a minister.
Did you go to his church?
No, of course not. Yeah. Are you kidding me? All the time. More than I wanted to. Trust me. Used to try to sneak out. Had to go to church.
How often? Once a week or more?
Once. All day Sunday. And then not that, because he worked so much, you know, we didn't have so many services during the week. But I was there all day on Sunday in Mamaroneck.
Were there certain, like, Bible passages that you were brought up with that were kind of favorites in the house?
Not that I remember. I couldn't give you one quote right off the bat. You know, what I learned and what I gleaned from my father was by example, you know, not by any particular saying or any, as you said, line to God or whatever, direct line, just the way he carried himself as a man of God, as a gentleman, and as a man totally committed to his beliefs. And it was a lot more subtle in his work ethic and things like that, not anything clever that he said or didn't say.
No, I think he was a minister in the Pentecostal Church. Is that
Church of God in Christ, yes.
Is that still a church that you belong to?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And does it, I guess I'm wondering if it has even more meaning because you were so brought up in it, you know, that your father was
no, such a part no, of it. It has meaning because it has meaning, because I believe in the scriptures. I'm a God-fearing man who believes what he reads in the Bible, and that has meaning. The meaning that it has is the effect that it has on me, it had on him, and thousands, if not millions, of other followers. And it's our faith in God and our belief in these commandments and in the story of the Bibles. You know, I've read the Bible a couple of times, working my way again through it. I'm now in the book of Romans and listening to the great examples and teachings of Paul and the perseverance and the faith that he had in spite of what he was up against. And I'm inspired by those teachings of Paul, of Luke, of all the apostles and the great leaders of the Old Testament as well, obviously Abraham and Moses.
My guest is Denzel Washington. He directed and stars in the new film, The Great Debaters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Denzel Washington. He directed and stars in the new film, The Great Debaters, which is nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Movie Drama. We were talking earlier about the acting lessons that you took and how you learned the kind of diction that you need to really have at your command as an actor. But I'm thinking, like with your father as a minister, he probably had a pretty commanding presence.
He did. Very commanding, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And a pretty powerful voice, probably.
Very big voice. Scary. My kids say I have the same thing. I scare them sometimes. I'm too big. You know, sneak up on them. But, yeah, very, very powerful presence, you know. And it wasn't the physical. It was really the spiritual. So you have to understand, everything I've done in my career and hopefully in my life is a reflection of my spiritual upbringing and cultivation. I'm not saying like oh, I've been an angel all my life. No, heaven knows I haven't, you know, but you learn, you know. In fact, I was, you know, because I had to go to church, I rebelled against the church. And there's probably many people out there who have gone through that based on whatever negative experiences they may have had. But I can say this to you, whatever success I have is a direct result of my faith and the grace of God in my life, period. It's not hanging out with the right people, and it's not studying or training at some school or acting school. It's a gift from God. I recognize that. We all have it. So the question is not what you have, but what are you going to do with what you have? But recognize that we all have that gift. It is the grace of God and a gift of God. Some it's acting, some it's radio, whatever your ministry, as they say, is. Understand where it comes from, and don't be ashamed of it. And if you've had negative experiences in church, because I'm talking about spirituality and not religion. You know, religion is where man gets a hold of it, and Lord knows, you know, that's where the problems begin. But if there's something still tugging at your heart, if you're not satisfied and you feel that there is something there, there is something there. And don't be ashamed or afraid to continue that search. You know, it led me through all kinds of religions, Eastern philosophies and Buddha and this and that.
Practicing, you, or just reading about it?
Practicing, reading, you know, poor practicing, you know, my own version of practicing, all of the above. You know, one of my favorite books is Siddhartha, you know, Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, because it is the journey. And the journey has led me back to the Bible.
During your period of rebellion, like, how far did you go in the other direction?
Why do you go right back to that? Huh? You know, that's what life is. That's why they call it experience. You have to sometimes go through life. You know, people tell you things and say, this is what you should do, but you need to find out for yourself. The reason that you pull your hand out of the fire is because it's hot. You know, somebody can tell you, but you still want to try it. And some people don't make it. Some people never pull their hand out. Some people fall in. And that's a part of life. But I was blessed to be able to get my hand out, to recognize the difference. And I think I am charged to share what I've learned with those around me. What you see in this example of that, you talked about Training Day. The first thing that I wrote on my script in Training Day was that the wages of sin is death. I don't know the exact verse in the Bible that comes from. But that's what I wrote down, which is why it was important for me, for the character, to die in the worst way, because he lived in the worst way. The wages of sin is death, and that's what he got. That's the message I was sending. And Malcolm X, the message I was interested in sending is that a man who experienced so much hatred, racial hatred, in his own life as a child, began to spew that same racial hatred toward others as an adult. until he came to a place in his life where in his religion, in this case Islam, he realized that there are Muslims of all colors, that this hatred of white people was wrong. So for me, the story of in the movie Malcolm X, for my character Malcolm X, what I tried to portray was the spiritual evolution of Malcolm X. So I try to infuse that in everything I do.
We talked a little bit about your father and him being a minister, and your mother ran this beauty shop. What did you take away from that? I mean, you know, one of the things you need to do as an actor is look right for the part, change your hair, change your clothes. Are there things you picked up about that from your mother and her shop?
No. In fact, I work just the opposite. I work from the inside out, not from the outside in. I actually worked in a barbershop, which her partner owned. What I got from that had a lot to do with acting, because the greatest liars and storytellers in the history of America usually hang out in the barbershop. So there was a great laboratory of theatrical performances going on in the barbershop. But sometimes there is an outside handle, you know, to a character. Mo Better Blues, you pick up a trumpet. Hurricane, you learn to box. And a lot of actors and great ones like Laurence Olivier, you know, talked about sometimes just putting the right wig on. Maybe it is. Even in Malcolm X, maybe it was some of the physical things, the pointing of his finger or putting the glasses on or things like that that give you a handle. But for the most part, I work from the inside out.
One last question. Is there a particular movie that meant a lot to you when you were growing up that you watched many times?
Yep.
What would that be?
Wizard of Oz.
Really?
I love that movie. That was the event of the year. To watch, are you kidding me? The Wizard. I was like, turn Bonanza off. The Wizard of Oz is coming on. You know, Bonanza was huge. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, Bonanza was huge. That
yes.
was it. That's
yeah.
what we got to watch. Sunday night, Bonanza, Ed Sullivan Show, then Bonanza. You know, when I sign an autograph now, I always write God bless, and I put my name. And I got that from Red Skelton. Because at the end of the Red Skelton show, he would say, good night and God bless. And I was like, I always liked that. So I said, you know, I didn't say when I get famous because I wasn't even thinking about it then. But when I did sign my first autograph or whatever, one of the first, for whatever reason, I thought about that. And so thank you, Red Skelton.
Oh,
and thank you, Bonanza. And thank you, Auntie M.
Did you love
else.
The songs? Did you love the songs from the
Wizard of Oz? Are you kidding me? They followed a yellow brick road. Whatever a wizard was. Followed a yellow brick road. You know. I mean, that was you got to remember, they only showed that like once a year. What was it? What was the guy's name? Danny Kaye.
Oh, Danny Kaye.
Danny Kaye would introduce
yeah.
it. Right. Danny Kaye would introduce it. I mean, we couldn't wait. That was huge. Huge. And then, of course, King Kong.
Oh.
Yeah, because Million Dollar Movie,
they would show
the same movie
yes.
like 90 times
King
the same
Kong,
week.
Godzilla.
King Kong, Godzilla.
Hunchback of Notre Dame.
I didn't watch that one. You're asking me. This is what I remember.
Great. It's been so much fun to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Bye.
All right. Because.
Denzel Washington directed and stars in the new film The Great Debaters. Here's more music from the soundtrack of the film featuring Alvin Youngblood Hart and Teeny Hodges.
Had a little girl, she little and low. She used to love me, but she don't no more. You gotta step it up and go, yeah. Yeah, and go. Well, you can't stand pat, I clear. You got to step it up and go. Got a little girl, she stayed upstairs, trying to make a living by putting on airs. You got to step it up and go. Yeah, and go. Well, you can't stand pat, I clear. You got to step it up and go. Front door shut, back door too. Blinds pulled down, what you gonna do? You gotta step it up and go, yeah, and go. Well, you can't stand pat, I clear. You gotta step it up and go. girl, her name is Ball. Give a little bit, but she took it all. You gotta step it up and go, yeah. Yeah, go. Well, you can't stand pat, I cry. You got to step it up and go, yeah. Me and my baby walking down the street, telling everybody about the chief of police. You gotta step it up and go, yeah. Yeah, and go. Well, you can't stand pat, I cry. You gotta step it up and go. See my woman, tell her hurry home. Ain't had no loving since she been gone. You gotta step it up and go, yeah. Yeah, and go. Well, you can't stand pat, I cry. You got to step it up and go. When I sing this verse, ain't gonna sing no more. Hear my gal call, I got to go. I got to step it up and go, yeah. Yeah, and go. Well, you can't stand pat, I clear. You got to step it up and go.
Book critic Maureen Corrigan begins the new year in a retrospective mood by looking backward to the Los Angeles of the 1920s and 30s and the writer who immortalized it.
Anyone who's ever gone on a pilgrimage to the house of a beloved writer can identify, up to a certain point, with Judith Freeman's obsession. Freeman is a Raymond Chandler fan, and because she loves his writing so much, she wanted to get closer to the man himself. So Freeman set out to visit the places in and around Los Angeles that Chandler and his wife Sissy lived during their near 30-year marriage. Except this being L.A., the city of the relentless future, instead of, say, the Berkshires, Boston, or another one of those history-conscious northeastern literary locales, Freeman knows that there aren't any well-maintained Chandler houses where the great writer's library and desk knickknacks are preserved in climate-controlled amber. Instead, Freeman finds herself driving to addresses that turn out to be, at worst, demolished dead ends, or at best, apartment houses, bungalows, and hotels, many of them dumps. The Chandlers moved over 30 times during their L.A. years. Even when they had money, they always leased furnished flats or small houses, and they often restlessly moved on to yet another modest rental within months. In the noir tour of Chandlerland that she chronicles in her compelling book, The Long Embrace, Freeman visits every one of these crumbling shrines, hoping to pick up clues in the sun-dappled shadows. Like a distaff Philip Marlowe, Freeman conducts stakeouts on these places in her car. She even begins sipping gin gimlets, Chandler's cocktail of choice. Her metabiographical investigation may sound cute and contrived, but Freeman is in deadly earnest, and because of the hypnotic power of her writing, and of course the passages from Chandler's fiction and letters she cites, her case of spirit possession is contagious. I just might try a gimlet myself the next time, as Chandler wrote in The Big Sleep, the world seems a wet emptiness. As it can probably be said of most writers, Raymond Chandler was a man better to be haunted by than to be married to. He was, off and on, a philanderer, as well as an alcoholic and a depressive personality. In the final years of their marriage, Chandler and Sissy bought their first home, a seaside ranch house in La Jolla, which, of course, Freeman visits. As she describes it, the ocean view from the living room picture window is spectacular, but morose Chandler didn't much care for it. Too much water, he once said, too many drowned men. The one constant in Chandler's life was his adoration for Sissy, whom he married when he was 35 and she was 53, although Chandler at the time didn't know Sissy's true age, since she knocked off 10 years on her marriage license. When the pair married in 1924, Chandler was a repressed mama's boy, possibly still a virgin. Along with all the other familiar biographical mysteries of Chandler's life, Freeman dutifully delves into the speculation that Chandler was a closeted gay man. But that isn't the kind of closet she's most interested in investigating. The Long Embrace really excels at capturing the spirit and significance of place. All the while I was reading her book, I kept thinking of historian Mike Davis's great cultural studies of L.A., as well as, to mix my genres and California cities, Hitchcock's Vertigo. To read The Long Embrace is to be transported back, swooningly, to the L.A. of the 20s and 30s, a city that sold itself as the American Italy. Freeman not only evokes the mood of dust-moted locales like the Ambassador Hotel and the Old Union Station, but she's also astute in showing how Chandler excavated the meaning underlying the transient, often bizarre, man-made geography of L.A. Describing the boarded-up Clifton Cafeteria, once an L.A. landmark, Freeman reflects on a passage about diners from Chandler's novel The Little Sister, and uses that passage as a springboard to talk about the appeal in the 1930s of cavernous cafes like Clifton's, where fast food, cheap food, food that you selected yourself and put on a tray and pushed along a metal railing became inextricably wed not to mere nourishment, but to the possibility of escaping a haunting emptiness for a while. Throughout The Long Embrace, Freeman somehow manages the dexterous feat of paying homage to Chandler without being swallowed up in his gorgeous language. Like Sissy before her, Judith Freeman is a dame who knows how to hold her own with a man who's trouble.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Long Embrace, Raymond Chandler and the Woman He Loved by Judith Freeman. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.